as a reminder for us to arouse the enlightened attitude, the altruistic motivation of bodhicitta at the beginning of teachings. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings, all numbers filling the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. Can you all hear me? Okay. So today we're going to start in, I will only actually be working with Ringo Toku's book, page 64. And then what I'd like to do is, since so much of bodhicitta, the instruction is really to be developed through practice, not just intellectual understanding, I've pulled out my instructions that were given to me by Lamanorla Rinpoche many years ago when I was teaching on the 7 points of mind training, and specifically on the section of ultimate bodhicitta, where I really had no idea how to even approach that. And so I'll be leading us at the appropriate time, sooner than later, specifically through his instructions that he gave to me in how to approach the meditation. So I wanted to share that with you. So we're starting today, page 64. In Ringo Toku. So we know that the fourth antidote is the antidote to the problem, or the fourth, they call it the four obstacles, which is not knowing how to practice. And basically, it's training in Buddhahood, how to actually train on the path. And so the fourth antidote, it says, bodhicitta. We could define Gampopa's book as a manual for attaining Buddhahood, which is the most accomplished form of nirvana. To achieve it, bodhicitta is indispensable. Bodhicitta is the vow, the great aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. It is the wish to bring all beings to complete happiness, to the cessation of all suffering, to enlightenment, to Buddhahood. Gampopa quotes the Ornament of Perfect Realization, one of the five treatises transmitted by Maitreya to Asanga, which says, developing bodhicitta means longing for true, perfect enlightenment in order to benefit others. Bodhi means Buddha mind or understanding, knowledge, realization. Citta means mind. Bodhicitta, therefore, means mind of Bodhi, mind set on realization. The Buddha mind, the Bodhi, shows aspects of both wisdom and compassion. To become a Buddha, it is necessary to develop wisdom and compassion simultaneously. Bodhicitta encompasses both aspects. We distinguish two types of bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta corresponds to the wisdom aspect, while the compassion aspect is at the heart of relative bodhicitta. So we begin now his discussion or description of ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is the realization of truth, of the ultimate nature, of the ultimate reality. It is Buddha nature, the enlightened mind, which encompasses and pervades all phenomena. Gampopa defines ultimate bodhicitta as voidness with compassion as its essence. So I'll just continue, because that idea of voidness, of nothingness, it's obviously not void of, you know, of everything. It's saying that it's an emptiness with compassion as its essence, clear and unwavering, free from all speculative extremes. This is how it is presented in the sutras. A bodhisattva experiences it for the first time when upon reaching the first bhumi, so that's the first of the bodhisattva levels. It is actually this very experience that marks one's entrance into the first bhumi. Ultimate bodhicitta arises from understanding and meditation on the right view. the intellectual understanding of the right view usually happens long before the first bhumi, or the first level, at which, through the first flash of absolute bodhicitta, we experience the true nature of our mind and of phenomena. Meaning, of course, when we say the true nature of our mind and phenomena, as phenomena are all perceived by mind. However, we should know that intellectual understanding, although necessary and useful, is not sufficient and should be integrated into our experience so as to become true realization. The more clearly we perceive it, the more we progress from bhumi to bhumi, so those are levels to levels, to finally attain the last level, the 10th level, which is that of complete realization. All the veils of confusion are then lifted. That is Buddhahood. Our progress on the Bodhisattva path can therefore be measured by the degree of clarity with which we perceive the true nature of our mind. So the insight into ultimate bodhicitta is not the fruit of taking vows. And I inserted there of just taking vows. It's not the fruit of taking vows alone. It's not the fruit of, or continuing, and we cannot get it through somebody else's blessings, meaning that alone. We cannot say either that it is the direct result of study, reflection, and practice, but we can clear the way for its emergence through what we could call the three ways of generating ultimate bodhicitta. So what I take this to mean is that it's saying that we can't get it from outside, because actually the knowledge that's being referred to is not something newly produced. Rather, this non-conceptual wisdom, this state of the nature of mind and the recognition of the true nature of mind, is already fully innate within us. It's already perfect. It's just obscured by conceptual veils. Once these obscurations are removed, the true nature fully manifests. So that's the important point of saying it's not something that you get from something outside. It's just something already within us that needs to be uncovered. And so it's saying here, we can clear the way, again, I'm on the third line on that page, we can clear the way for its emergence from obscuration within, you know, the veils of our obscuring thoughts and emotions. We can clear the way for its emergence through what we could call the three ways of generating ultimate bodhicitta. First of all, there is the study, the deep understanding that one can gain through studying the teachings of the Buddhas. Then there is the accumulation of great merit and great wisdom. Finally, there is the realization of wisdom by the development and then the emergence of perfectly pure, non-conceptual wisdom. Bodhicitta can sometimes develop through the inspiration we receive from our spiritual guide, if we have such a guide. It can also develop by the power of our natural compassion. Certain methods are more stable than others. Bodhicitta arising from inspiration, meaning inspiration from someone, a spiritual guide that we are inspired by to emulate, is less stable than bodhicitta generated by performing good actions, reflecting on the teachings, acquiring a better understanding of bodhicitta, and taking meditation and practice as a way of life. These are the best ways of developing it. So now what I'd like to do is we're going to step back from this text, and I'm now going to introduce, as I said, teachings that I received directly from Lama Norla Rinpoche many years ago, when I was tasked with helping to teach the 7 points of mind training. And so we begin with our meditation, and we should all settle in, you know, sitting as best we can, however we are, with a straight spine. And as it says in the 7 points of mind training, it's always good to begin with a form of guru yoga. And I'm going to introduce a very brief introduction, something we haven't brought up in this class before, but it comes from a different course that I was involved with in Lama Chodron. And it's a shortened form of guru yoga. So there's a term that's known as Lama Cheno. And This means basically that you know, you care for us, you help us. So you're calling out to the Lama. And so the meditation is, and excuse me, I'm trying to adjust my knee is still a little funky. Okay, so having adjusted our posture, and let's take a moment to just settle ourselves to see and feel where we might have any gripping or in our muscles or stress in our body, and allow ourselves to just let go and relax a little bit and settle. And so the instruction is, you can imagine the guru on the top of your head. So whoever you see as your Lama in this moment, whoever you have feelings of inspiration, whoever in your heart has benefited you tremendously, so that can be seen as an authentic Lama, then imagine that Lama on the crown of your head in the form as this, the blue form of Dorje Chang Vajradhara, and supplicate thinking, Lama Cheno. Imagine that the Lama knows us, cares for us, is there to help us. This naturally reminds us to practice to come back home. And now think that the Lama dissolves into light and merges with our heart. Rest there, and just for a moment, look at the mind. This is the essence of practice. And now I begin with the training from Lama Norla Rinpoche on ultimate bodhicitta. So firstly, we must cut through our ordinary pattern of continually following after every thought that arises. To do this, the instruction is, do not follow after the past. The past is finished, so do not think about it. Do not anticipate the future. After all, by definition, the future has not yet come. Do not think, I will do this or I have to do that. Whatever thought arises, merely recognize it for what it is and let go of clinging. Rest without distraction in the present moment of awareness. Then within this state, reflect that all phenomena are like dreams. Actual phenomena, that is the world and its with our senses. But these appearances are simply manifestations of deluded mind. Ultimately, these appearances do not have even the slightest bit of true existence. They are but like appearances in a dream. Reflect that all perceived objects are not single, independent entities, but depend on a countless number of factors for their appearance. So any given object, our cushion, our chair, whatever it is in front of us right now, any given object that we're perceiving, none of these exist as a single thing in an unchanging way. With our knowledge of modern science, we are aware of the atomic breakdown of anything material, that the more we investigate, everything comes down to energy constantly in flux. And although we may intellectually understand this, we still feel that the cushion we're sitting on, or the chair, or the bench or table in front of us, all of these still feel like we think they are solid, real objects. We delude ourselves thinking that our coarse perceptions are in fact how things actually are. So the first instruction is to cultivate some feeling for the phantom-like nature of experience in which the perceived objects simply appear, empty of any kind of inherent, substantial, material existence, just like the images that arise in dreams. Then again, try to rest the mind in non-distractive. Whatever thoughts or emotions arise, recognize them as soon as they appear for what they are, thinking, oh, that's a thought or that's an emotion, and without following after it, let it go, let go of clinging. Simply try and rest within the present moment of awareness. Then within this state, examine the nature of unborn awareness. Examine the mind, that which is aware. So when thoughts arise, examine who's thinking those thoughts. Who's thinking I? Is there a self who is thinking? For if there is an I, if an I exists substantially, it must have defining characteristics. So examine the mind, that which is aware. Look to see if it has a shape or a color, a size. Does it arise from anywhere? Is it located anywhere, inside or outside the body? Does it go anywhere or cease to exist? Upon examination, the mind, that which is aware, cannot be found to exist anywhere. It has no origin, location, or cessation. Nothing or no thing can be found. Rest the mind in the essence of the one who understands, in that which is aware. Rest in bare awareness, which is beyond characteristics. Now, perhaps, one will replace clinging to the existence of mind with clinging to thoughts about its empty nature, thinking mind and body are empty, and in emptiness there is nothing which is beneficial or harmful. At that time, reflect, even the remedy is free to subside naturally. So when you look at the very essence of the remedy, this being the thoughts about the absence of true existence, recognize that these remedial thoughts also lack existence. Looking directly at these thoughts, there is no thing for the mind to refer to, and so they subside naturally. They too are self-liberated. The profound instruction for placement is simply this. Rest in the essence, the nature of the all basis. Rest in the essence itself, just as it is. If one asks, what is the all basis, the essence of mind? To what does this word refer? Lama Norla Rinpoche has said, whatever arises to the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness rest in the essence of that which is aware. Look at the mind in the midst of experiencing all the myriad emotions. So here's the instruction. Firstly, right now, imagine a pleasurable sense of conditions. Look at the essence of the one thinking, I am happy. Look and see if that which is aware of the thought, I am happy, is actually experiencing happiness. So again, the instruction is conjure up some set of circumstances that brings a pleasant feeling to mind. And when you're aware of feeling pleasant, ask, is that which is aware of feeling pleasant, or of the thought, the idea of pleasant, itself actually experiencing happiness? And now conjure up the conditions which might bring about a thought of anger or jealousy or sadness. Look directly at the essence of that which is thinking, I am angry or I am sad. And ask yourself, is the awareness of that emotion, of that thought, is that awareness itself actually experiencing suffering? When looking at the basis, the essence of mind, see that it itself is unchanging, unaffected by the thoughts themselves. This unchanging aspect of mind, the essence of mind itself, is like the sky in which clouds appear. Although they appear within the sky itself is unchanged by their appearance. This, Lama Norla Rinpoche taught, is the most important point. The unchanging essence is identical in both Buddhas and sentient beings. The only distinction is that sentient beings, not recognizing that essence, cling to their thoughts, to the self they posit as being truly existent. They are lost to this confused perception and so suffer continually in samsara. Buddhas recognize the essence of mind, the essence of all phenomena, and so do not fall under the power of confusion. This is what is meant by liberation. So that completes Lama Norla Rinpoche's instructions on the meditation on ultimate bodhicitta as found in the 7 points of mind training. So we should all sort of move around a little bit, having just meditated, take a break. And before we continue, does anyone have any thoughts or questions or before we move on? Because we'll be returning now to page 66 in Rinko Tuku's text on relative bodhicitta. Marilyn, can you?
I unmuted her, she's
okay, unmuted. Thank you. Hi, Marilyn.
I'm probably expressing what we all feel, but certainly what Patrick and I feel, that we are so grateful that you brought that to us, a teaching.
Well, you know, it's funny. I talked earlier to Lama Chidren. I wasn't sure because I'm not very good at naturally going through this level of ultimate bodhicitta, but these were teachings that he gave years ago, and I was in his, you know, his old room, and I had a translator with me, and really myself just going through them now. I mean, they were so special, and he was, you know, so I'm so glad, you know, I wanted to share them because... And I'm glad that you enjoyed them too. Yeah. Oh, John.
Okay, I've unmuted him.
Okay, someone's got some sort of thing noise going on in the background. Oh, okay, carry on.
Okay, so do you have any advice on how to bring this about during our daily experience? Because what we just did now as an exercise, it's easier for me to see that it's a thought which is not the true I, so to speak, or the ultimate I, or what have you. But so how do we do this with not just working with a thought, but as it's happening. Do you have any advice for that?
Well, first of all, I'll share with you what the post-meditation instruction is from the 7 points of mind training for ultimate bodhicitta. And then I'll speak, because I believe you asked something different, but I was busy finding this. So after I go through this, you can rephrase your question if it doesn't speak to it. Mm-hmm. And it says, in post-meditation practice, and again, these are, as you can see, handwritten notes that were mostly either transcribed from teachings Lama Norla Rinpoche gave years ago, or, so I can't tell you which book I'm actually reading from. I think they're coming from Lama Norla Rinpoche's teaching that I transcribed. But in any case, it is based on the 7 points of mind training that of the Ken MacLeod translation anyway. But okay, so it says, in post-meditation practice, be a child of illusion. So constantly foster the attitude that you yourself and others, the animate and inanimate world, while none of these are inherently existent, still appear. Be like a child of illusion and recognize this lack of true existence. So when one arises from meditation, maintain the understanding that all appearances are not truly existent, but are illusory in nature, like the images in a dream. So one way is to begin to remind yourself at different points of the day to take a moment and begin to let go of this absolute, you know, deeply ingrained assumption that everything that exists around us ultimately exists exactly as it appears, as a solid, you know, rigid structure or something that, again, we think materialistically exists. Try to let go even for a moment of the clinging and suggest to yourself or remind yourself, like, what is it like in a dream where you experience things, but in that moment where you wake up, you have just a split second where you realize, oh my God, that image, that whole feeling I had, that absolutely never existed as anything other than appearance in my mind, as an experience in my mind. And then, in, you know, take moments to look around you and try to lessen again that hold on the feeling of solidity of, you know, actuality of everything being there truly existent, and just allow yourself to take moments like that. That's one way in the, you know, in it's taught, you know, again, like a child, to be able to just let go, you know, to also to in meditation evaluating that, oh my gosh, like everything we experience is filtered through our mind. So everything we're experiencing ultimately is still thoughts. We're not actually non-conceptually, as long as there's some sense of a characteristic that we attribute to something, there's some sort of conceptuality going on there. And to look then and say, well, wait a second, I'm seeing this happen outside, but in fact, I'm really experiencing it in my mind, because all I'm truly experiencing is all my thoughts about it. And then in that moment, maybe, you know, let go of clinging to the thoughts and just relax, you know, for a few seconds, you know, that kind of, so it's just sort of to periodically continue to try to disengage from that habit. Does that help? You're muted again, John. Wait, you have to unmute yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. That was good. Thank you.
That helps? Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? Dave? Lama Chidrin, can you, because for some reason my co-host, I can't see. I can't quite see anything. Would you mind?
He's unmuted. I'm unmuting people.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You can just look and see, like in the top corner, mute or unmute. You can see if people are unmuted or not.
Oh, I see what you're, I see. And then I can actually, in the pictures, I can go there. Okay. I'm going to get rid of that participant box. Okay. Very good. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks so much. Yeah, this is really awesome practice. I wanted to note and question. I really like how in the presentation here, Ultimate Bodhicitta comes first before relative bodhicitta and before other things. If you were looking at it like from a Western educational perspective, this is like the perhaps more deep teaching, or, you know, the way we feel about it, but yet it comes first, whereas like we would unfold the concept of like shallower then to deeper. And it seems to me like this is key, because then when we're doing the other practices, especially relative bodhicitta, it all happens from within this perspective. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Do you guys feel like that is why it's oriented in this way?
I can't speak to why it's oriented in that way specifically, but I'd like to share with you, because many people have had that question and actually asked it of the previous Kala Rinpoche, and I actually have his answer to that question of why practice ultimate before relative.
Yeah.
So although the practice of developing relative bodhicitta is the principal meditation, the meditation on ultimate bodhicitta is introduced first. If one asks why, Kala Rinpoche taught that even a slight understanding of emptiness will cause the natural development of compassion, enabling one to appreciate that other sentient beings wander through the realms of samsara and suffer as they do because they do not recognize emptiness. They suffer from the misapprehension that what is impermanent is permanent, and that what is unreal or untrue is real or true. And one naturally feels compassion for beings in such a state. As a result, one's practice develops two elements, the aspect of emptiness, which is wisdom, and the aspect of compassion, which is method. And by this practice alone, one can reach Buddhahood. So that's one reason, the idea that it's connecting you with other beings having the same ignorance as you do. And so recognizing that helps to awaken a sense of compassion for others who, like yourself, are suffering out of ignorance. His second reason, though, and this was very good, is that because many people are afraid to do taking and sending, because they're afraid that they'll take something on and be harmed by it, etc. So he says, those who have not recognized the meaning of emptiness believe in an ego or an I that exists inherently. Such persons might fear that taking and sending meditation will make them miserable. But if one has recognized the meaning of emptiness, and if the misapprehension of an I has been cut through, then one will understand that there is no one, no I, to experience the suffering of others. Egolessness is like a cloudless sky, for without clouds, there is no possibility of rain, hail, thunder, or lightning. And then I have written, if one has great compassion, then one will not only be willing, but actually eager to take on the suffering of others, because sentient beings who equal space and extent have all been parents of every one of us, it would seem fitting to take on their suffering in order to free them, and one contemplates this with great joy.
Thanks.
So that's the answer direct from an enlightened being of the reasons. Okay. So now we'll go back to, I just want to put this back. I sort of have these things numbered. And I mean, these are really precious teachings, aren't they? They're just unbelievable. Okay, so next, I'll figure this out later. Okay, so next we return to Rinku Tuku and his discussion on relative bodhicitta. Okay, sorry, just... I'm sort of, because I'm not able to sit cross-legged right now. I'm on a chair, but I'm using my bed. Blah, blah. Okay, here we go. So we're back to Rinku Tuku. And we're on page 60 now. And it says, relative bodhicitta has two levels, the bodhicitta of aspiration and the bodhicitta of commitment. On this subject, there is a slight difference between the view of Nagarjuna and that of Sangha. According to Nagarjuna's definition, which Shantideva and Gampopa endorse, the difference between these two kinds of bodhicitta is the same as that between saying, I want to go to Paris, and actually going there. The bodhicitta of aspiration is when we think the infinite number of beings who inhabit the universe to the very end of space all desire happiness and loathe suffering. However, as long as they remain in confusion and ignorance, they will continue to suffer. The only state that is free of all suffering is perfect enlightenment. We then commit ourselves to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, so that we can free them from suffering. Such a vow, combined with a deep desire to realize it, is the bodhicitta of aspiration. Taking steps to make this wish come true, for example, by taking vows and observing them, by starting up a charity, by trying to be more tolerant, or by following a program of meditation or study, everything which helps us to realize our aspiration is, according to Shantideva, the bodhicitta of commitment, or engagement, or action. On this subject, he says, just as one knows the difference between wanting to go and actually going, so the sage should distinguish between these two respectively. According to a Sangha, promising to obtain a result is the bodhicitta of aspiration, whereas committing oneself to put into action the means to bring this about, harnessing oneself to the cause, is commitment bodhicitta. In other words, saying, I want to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings corresponds to the bodhicitta of aspiration. Our objective is clear, but we have so far done nothing to attain it. If we add, to realize this objective, I am going to practice the six paramitas, then it becomes the bodhicitta of commitment. So, you know, that's like when we have in our prayer, I'm going to, it, where we have the prayer that says, the refuge, through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for benefit of beings. So from a Sangha's point of view, that is actually the, you know, by saying through all the virtues of practicing the six paramitas, such as giving and the other six, etc., may I reach Buddhahood just by making that statement and committing yourself to it, that becomes application. Whereas it seems in the first case, you actually have to act in some kind of way, such as starting a charity or, you know, acting virtuously to, you know, taking vows, that's actually what in his mind is more of a commitment. So now we're going to put that book down, and I'm going to now give us instructions for relative bodhicitta, taking and sending. So again, adjust your posture, take a moment to relax and notice if there's any gripping or any discomfort in the body, to allow that to let go. And so I'll begin with again, this is coming from Lama Norla Rinpoche's teachings, and he's giving a commentary that he got from Kalu Rinpoche, the previous Kalu Rinpoche. So it says, Kalu Rinpoche taught, the essence of the bodhisattva vow is to renounce self-cherishing and cultivate the attitude which is firmly directed towards the benefit of others. To embark on the bodhisattva path, one must aspire to and actively train in exchanging oneself for others, putting others before oneself, regarding them just as important as, and ultimately more important than oneself. How then can we train in this form of exchange? The most powerful method taught to effect this self-transformation is found within the profound instructions known as Lojong, or the 7 points of mind training. And so now what I'm going to refer to, and again, you're just meditating, just listening comfortably to the words, is I'm actually using a bit of instruction directly from Ringu Toku's book, page 62. This was in his instruction for how to meditate on loving kindness and compassion. So actually, if you want to look, or it's page 62, where it says, according to our tradition, or well, actually above that, the method that allows us to develop compassion is where I'm starting. But again, you can just relaxedly listen. So it says, the method that allows us to develop compassion is identical to that used for developing loving kindness. We visualize our mother and imagine her undergoing great suffering. Imagine her being tortured. What would be the intensity of our compassion? Now, other beings, like those who are born in hell, continuously suffer such incredible tortures. According to our tradition, we think of our mother, but you can visualize in her place the person for whom you feel the greatest love, and imagine how you love him or her, how you couldn't stand it if anything bad happened to that person. Having developed this strong feeling, you try to extend it to others, aware that you once had with all other beings the same relationship that you now have with this person. We've wandered in samsara for such a long time that all beings have at some point been our mothers, our close relatives, or our friends. All these beings have had the same love and kindness for us as the love and kindness that our mother has extended to us in this life. It's therefore normal to feel for them the same love, the same gratitude, and the same compassion that we feel for our mother in this life. The basic idea is that if we can love one person very strongly, we can develop the same feeling for 2, 10, or 1,000 people or more. First, we develop benevolence and compassion for those who are close to us, and then we extend these feelings to those to whom we are indifferent, and finally include our enemies, remembering that enemies are acting, again, completely out of ignorance, and they absolutely have no idea how to act differently. So although we might blame them or feel, you know, very upset about this action, we have to remember or begin to develop a habit where we think these beings also are acting completely out of ignorance. And due to the ripening of karma, they too will experience the consequences. Although we may not see it, it will ripen to them in a future lifetime. So instead of imagining our mother or someone who is dear to us, we can also imagine what we would experience if we ourselves had to endure the unbearable tortures of the different infernal realms, and in this way develop a great compassion for all the beings who suffer likewise. All sentient beings seek happiness, well-being, peace, and security. But through ignorance, they do the exact opposite of what would ensure the enduring happiness they seek. They accumulate bad karma and acquire again and again the causes of subsequent sufferings, like blind men in the middle of a burning desert, walking around in circles, not knowing how to get out. We aspire to happiness and we fear suffering, and other beings are no different from us on that point. When we recognize this evidence, we naturally wish to help them. And with this as our motivation, imagine that yourself, you can imagine yourself as a light body, you know, again, not solid, rigid, flesh and bone. And imagine yourself that with an inhalation, you can imagine yourself that incoming from all directions, radiating from all sentient beings. Or we can start by starting with those we feel closest to, for whom it's most easy to develop, you know, who have such a strong connection with us that we want them so deeply to be free from suffering. Imagine that all of their suffering, all of their obscurations, all of these in the form of black light, you can think. It's often taught black, you know, like soot or a smoke. But if you like light, you know, anything, again, it's immaterial. It's insubstantial. It's all of the suffering and causes of suffering. Imagine that it's entering into you. And you can imagine that it dissolves at your heart level. And imagine that your suffering as well, all of this just dissolves into emptiness, into your Buddha nature. And by doing so, all sentient beings you can think are permanently relieved of. They're completely liberated from all their suffering and the causes of their suffering. And then let go of clinging to even that thought. Rest in that which is aware of having thought this. So rest in that which is bare awareness. And now think again, your body, a body of light. You can think that when you exhale, think that all of your own suffering, I mean, all of your own happiness, all of your own virtue, all of that which provides relief and comfort, all of that radiates outward in all directions as white light. And you can think that it dissolves into the body, speech and mind of all beings, and in that moment think that all beings are freed from all forms of suffering, that they are completely filled with a state of joy. And then just again rest in the essence of that which is aware. So we'll now take some time to just practice taking and sending. Again, you're alternating. And the point is that you're not doing with it each inhalation and exhalation, but as your mind begins to wander, you use it as a form of skillful means, as a type of shene meditation, as a focal object. So you can think, again, as your mind wanders, you can think that, again, if you have someone you're close with, or if you want to begin extending it outwards to those you don't know personally but are suffering, or, you know, to those that you are able to feel some compassion for, those who you even have some aversion towards, and finally to all beings, whatever you're comfortable with. Again, you're imagining that with as an inhalation, you're thinking that in the form of black light, all of their suffering and causes of suffering are dissolving in, along with your own causes of suffering and suffering, dissolving into emptiness at the heart level. And imagine that all beings, including oneself, are completely freed from any form of suffering. And then let go to clinging to that thought and just rest. And as long as you're able to simply rest, remain there. But then when a thought arises and you notice you've been distracted, you can simply notice you've been distracted, welcome that. No, there's no harm in that. It's just the dynamic expression of mind. And now you can imagine that with white light emanating in all directions, radiating outwards, that all that happiness and causes of happiness, all beings in that moment are experiencing freedom, complete freedom from suffering, are in a state of unchanging joy. And then again, let go to clinging of that thought and just relax. And so we'll, at our own pace, work with the practice of taking and sending. So that completes practice on taking and sending on the relative bodhicitta. So again, stretch a little bit, move a little bit.
Okay. John had his hand up, so I've unmuted him.
Oh, please, yes.
I have just a comment, and it has to do with I dawned on me as you were talking about the difference, the Sangha's distinction between aspiration bodhicitta and action bodhicitta, that this is where we can tie in taking the vow, because that gives it that commitment towards the aspiration, that extra step towards it, I think. But that's just my comment.
Well, I think that personally, exactly, when our refuge prayer, where we say, in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, I take refuge, it says, through all the virtues such as giving, well, here it says, may I, but you can equally simply say, I will reach Buddhahood for the benefit of beings. And that becomes your vow, your commitment. You know, I mean, I don't know if you think of the distinction between, like, I'm looking here, through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for all beings? May, does that fall into aspiration? But you can say, you know, I will reach Buddhahood. And that becomes the vow, the act of, you know, taking an actual, we're actually saying, I'm going to do it. But that alone is no longer just aspiration, which is, I want to do it, but the differentiation than saying, I'm going to do it, you know? Whereas the first one says, well, first is like, I want to go to New York, but that's aspiration, but the actual going to New York becomes, I mean, the actual physically going. So again, both of these points are, they're sort of to me a moot point. I mean, to me, it's, we all know within our, well, I know within myself when I say, I want to do, you know, I know where I'm at when I go through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. If I actually have within my heart, within my mind, that thought, I'm really going to do this, then that becomes actual, you know, commitment of bodhicitta. Whereas when I know that I'm just doing lip service, then in my mind, that's, you know, I don't even know if it's just lip, if it even counts as aspiration, if I'm not really actually feeling it. But I think that for me personally, that's something that each and every, you know, we can find for ourselves, you know, what it means. Yeah, children.
Oh. I think also, I agree with all of that. And I think also John may have been referring to our class last week when we talked about taking vows in order to engender bodhicitta. And John, I had the exact same thought when Ringu Tukla says at the top of page 67, taking steps to make this wish come true, for example, by taking vows. I think we're talking about, like, maybe this is where the formal vows fit in. And Ringu Tulku expressed it as not absolutely necessary, but here he's saying it would strengthen. You know, it might be one way to actually strengthen your, you know, embarking upon commitment bodhicitta. Okay. Yep.
I see that. Thank you.
I made a note to myself to add that to the post. Okay. So thanks for bringing that up, John.
So, Joanne.
All right, Lama. I just need some clarification. In Nandro, the preliminary practices, every day I'm saying the Bodhisattva's vow three times. Mm-hmm. Is that what John is referencing at this point? Because I am saying it's more than I wish. I'm saying I will.
Yes, I believe you are actually taking a vow. You're saying, or you're making a commitment by saying I will. You know, that's a commitment. And so in my mind, that falls into the bodhicitta of commitment versus aspiration. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Lama Chodron, do you have any other thought? Is that, would you agree with that?
That's, well, just again, I think that there's just different levels of taking vows. I mean, even with the bodhisattva vow and refuge, the text says, Gampopa says, you can do it on your own. Like if you can't, but it's stronger if you take it with, like if you receive it from a realized teacher. And here I think, again, John was probably referring to the discussion last week of when Gampopa said, that the prerequisites for truly engendering bodhicitta are to take refuge and to take a level of formal vows, pratimoksha vows. But I think your point is also, and what Joanne's asking you also fits into the point that you're making, that according to the text, it counts. According to Asanga's view, Atisha's view, it counts.
I also think that, you know, because ultimately it's not something somebody else can give us. You know, even if we've formally taken the bodhisattva vow, unless we are training our mind and again and again habitually saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do, nothing's going to happen. So in my mind, it's the training. It's you're entering into, you know, you're vowing that I will train as all the previous Buddhas and Bodhisattvas did before me, you know, with my body, speech, and mind. So I think that, you know, the practice, the first practice of prostrations in bodhicitta is the training in developing bodhicitta. You know, that's active training. That's part of that activity. Anything else, anyone? Okay, so what time is it now? So we'll continue. And I think what we'll do is we're going to continue page, well, we'll just continue page 67. This is now the, we're in the middle of the page where it says the causes, because now we're going to talk about just ever so briefly, three causes for relative and three causes for ultimate bodhicitta. So this is in Path to Buddhahood, page 67. And it says, the causes that help us develop relative bodhicitta are having a good spiritual guide who inspires us. 2, the impetus of our karma by which we feel natural compassion. This positive karma is the result of a great accumulation of merit and wisdom gained through different practices, study, and meditation. So I'm imagining this refers to where we talked about early on about having the various families, and we are now awakened within ourselves where we naturally have at this moment already a feeling of natural compassion, such that we, through the inspiration of a good spiritual guide, we are able to, or we wish to actually continue to develop it. So again, it says, where did this positive karma arise in this life? It arose from previous lives. Plus what you've done in this life is obviously reinforcing it, but of the result of great accumulation of merit and wisdom gained through different practices, study, and meditation. And then the causes that help us generate ultimate bodhicitta are threefold. So it says a deep understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, a great accumulation of merit and wisdom, and the realization of primordial conceptual wisdom. So again, the realization is based on the fact that this is not something newly produced that we have to learn about. It's already within us, and we have to, and we enable it to emerge. We enable it to manifest through the practices which remove the obscurations towards our recognizing that. So I'm not sure what to do. We're now at 315. Where we go in this book is page, we skip over the refuse section and we pick up again on page 76. And it's page 76 to 80. And then in speaking with Lama Chogyam this morning, I realized there's a little section at the very end of the Gompopa book, Ornament of Precious Liberation, which it talks about what you have to do to break the vow and how you can then renew the vow. It actually includes the following chapter in this text, which is a fairly short one, which I can cover next week. So I'm just wondering if what we should do, because we're sort of a funny breaking point here, Lama Chogyam.
I just, before we leave page 67, just wanted to point out one thing. The very end of that section where it has the list of three causes for ultimate bodhicitta, which is the same thing explained on page 66, that I think it could be a little confusing because it says wisdom in both 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that the wisdom that we accumulate in the second cause is Cherub. That's the wisdom of realizing emptiness. And the wisdom that's being referred to in the third one is Yeshe, the
primordial,
our Buddha nature, right? The innate wisdom that we have. So that's where English becomes confusing because we often call both of them wisdom.
So the idea, as I'm relating to them then, is that you're accumulating wisdom, which is the wisdom, which is the means, the methods right. to train us how to let go and how to remove the obscurations of clinging to things right. of truly existing. And that's what then enables us to recognize the primordial wisdom already within.
Right, exactly. It's the wisdom in the second one is the wisdom that's the sixth paramita, which is transcendent wisdom or Cherub or the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Yeah, the methods of what you just did, the guided meditation you took us through, is the wisdom that we accumulate in order to realize our innate wisdom.
So I sort of feel like maybe since next week, it's not that much material to go through its pages again in this text, 76 through 80. And then in Ornament of Precious Liberation, which I'm not referring to because I'm finding it way too, it's way, I'm not relating to it. And I think that it's, you know, as Lama Chidrin had, you know, shared with us, it's for a different group of people at a very different time. And I found it to be like an all or nothing thing. You know, it was a little scary even reading it, you know, where the Lord of Death is going to meet you and, you know, and all his henchmen and all of that. And especially since we've already covered so much of when we were going through the various states of samsara, the realms of samsara, and we had that great teaching shared by Pema Chodron, you know, and I guess it was Tim Olmsted, or was it Cortland? I'm not sure which one.
But Tim Olmsted.
You know, the idea that realms are states of mind. And so, but I am referring on pages in this white book, The Ornament of Precious Liberation, the pages that I will briefly point out, if only bullet points, are pages 142, which is on the causes for losing, which isn't clear there. It's further explained in the next chapter, and briefly how to restore the vow. And I will cover then, continue in the book, the next chapter, which is not that long, up to page 150. And again, if you'd like to read that, feel free. I'm only going to be giving a sort of a, you know, a paraphrasing a lot of it. It isn't going to be read word for word, but that will then complete you know, the final two sections of what it is that would break the Bodhisattva vow and what it is that you can do to restore it, which it can be restored. So that's where we're going next week. So does anyone else have anything they'd like to talk about or say now, Chidrin?
All that said, and I totally concur with it, I would like to point out one passage in Ornament of Precious Liberation right at the beginning of chapter 9. Which is one of my favorite passages in all of this book, which is not grim or, you know, all or nothing at all, but it's the third topic, types of bodhicitta, on page 111. It's the
it's very poetic.
It's very poetic. It's very beautiful. And he gives the list of similes, which is just fun to read aloud. And then he explains how each one relates to bodhicitta. So I just encourage everyone to read that one section.
Actually, I had that broken down. So it's page 111 through halfway through 113. And what it is it's the 22 aspects of bodhicitta presented by means of similes, which cover the entire path from the beginner's level through Buddhahood. And so it breaks them down into the different the paths to Buddhahood, which will be presented to us in much greater detail, chapter 18 of the book. So You don't have to worry about it. I did actually have a note, very poetic, if you'd like to read on your own.
yeah, that's fine. I just encourage people to not skip it. Even if you only read the list, like you don't even have to think about how it relates to the path or how each one relates to bodhicitta, but just a lovely list of sort of scintillating things that bodhicitta is likened to.
So yes, I did at one point think I was going to do that, and then I forgot, but that's exactly what I had thought would be. That's certainly a nice part of, you know, a very poetic part of the text anyway.
Anne is unmuted.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, thank you. I have the old version of Gampopa's book. Yeah. Can you give me a general area that is covered in?
It's the very beginning of the bodhicitta chapter okay. 9, and I'm looking up the pages right now.
Oh, the simile?
Yeah, page 147 in the old Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which is also a lovely translation. Yeah,
thank you.
I'm curious if they're all translated the same way, so I'll have to look.
Anne, is it this book you have? The Jewel Ornament of Liberation?
Yes.
Did you already answer it? I had my headsets off.
We got it. Yeah, we got it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's page 147 in Jewel Ornament.
147.
It's nice they have different title translations, so we can say Jewel Ornament meaning the blue book, or Ornament of Religious Liberation meaning the white book.
Yeah, so, you know, it's again a short section, and you don't have to worry about the breakdown of the paths, because actually there's a note. It seems to be almost six paths in the way they broke it down. And then there's actually a note that I went to the back of the book at one point, and it says that the way it's broken down in this tiny little section is actually different than how it's broken down, something to do with the path of, the path of cultivation. Wait, which one was it? Something to do with, if you look at page 112 in the white book, and at the very bottom, the last full paragraph, it says, these 10 mentioned above correspond to the respective order to the 10 bodhisattvas, blah, blah, to the 10th. Thus, they lie within the sphere of path of seeing and path of cultivation. And when I went to that note of 160, it says it's described differently in chapter 18. So that's why I have no interest in really, you know, really thinking about how they relate. As she said, is they're just very lovely, you know, similes that you can take it just for that.
You could probably make a wrap out of it.
Does anyone else have any thoughts or? Oh, Dave?
Dave, you're unmuted.
Going back to the end of 67 there, the ultimate bodhicitta causes, you guys were talking about the two types of wisdom. In this case, you said accumulation of merit and wisdom. The wisdom there is Shara. Mm-hmm. And then the realization of primordial non-conceptual wisdom, that's Yeshe.
Yes.
Go ahead, sorry.
Can you give me the Sanskrit for each of those? Because I have the Sanskrit ones in my head, and I'm like, is Shara Prajna?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then what is Yeshe?
What is
Jhana?
Okay, cool, thank you.
And the clue here is the word accumulation, because you can't accumulate what's innate, but you accumulate.
Yeah.
I think of them as acquired wisdom versus innate wisdom.
Nice.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're all just resting in awareness of the one who is, resting in the essence of the one who is sitting here and waiting for questions.
I'm not actually, I'm even really comfortable with, we're just sitting. You know, I don't time it, but I just didn't feel like going forward, because it would be just a little bit. It didn't seem like the right thing to do, so.
I always, in Buddhist gatherings, when things fall silent, I always say Buddhists know what to do with silence.
Yeah. Why don't we actually just meditate then a little bit? Again, adjust our posture. And in this moment, you just, again, notice where there's any tension or any kind of, where you're gripping in any way, and just allow yourself to relax. And you can let go of thoughts of the past. The past no longer exists. Thoughts about the past are merely ideas in the present moment. So you can just let go of any clinging, just as it were, just look right through the content and just let it go. And then thoughts about the future, any laundry lists we have of what we need to do or where we need to go. Again, the future also doesn't exist by definition. It hasn't yet come. Thoughts about the future are merely concepts we're having in the present. So again, just let those go. And in a, just a very welcoming way, whatever arises, again, the mind is a dynamic phenomena. So whatever movement arises in the mind, like waves in the water, you just, you know, can just let go of any kind of clinging and remain in the present moment of awareness. So we'll end today's session. Lama Chudrin, if you want to just do the dedication of merit prayers.
I'm looking for where I put them. Somehow misplaced my prayer sheet. Would you be up to leading them, Lama Chudrin?
Sure. I just don't remember. Do you do all four?
All four, yes. All four.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Sampo, and Manjushri, to train myself in their example. I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Lovely class, Lama Jinzong. And I just want to remind everybody that if you want to go through this guided meditation again, the recording will be up in a couple of days. If you want to transcribe her notes from Lama Norla Rinpoche, which are handwritten, so she can't easily share them with us.
And the white and the pencils fading away. I'm like, oh,
yeah. I'll transcribe it if we want to have those instructions.
And your also, what?
I said your phone has a camera right on it there.
Yeah. Oh, you can just.
Well, yes. Sometimes it's handwritten notes, though. It's tricky.
And then also that wonderful that Lama Norla Rinpoche offered the teaching from Kala Rinpoche on why the presentation of ultimate before relative is so meaningful. You know, that's that was really a great answer because, you know, that's always everybody, not everybody, but most of us have had that question. So, okay, well, thank you, everyone. See you again next Thursday.
Thank you.
Okay. I shall exercise the superpower. See you next week.